Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. College freshmen are moving into dorms across the country, and some of them may have an idea about what they want this next step in their lives to look like. Adam Lundquist did, but what he didn't know was how it would all change in an instant. Nico Tortorella from the TV land show Younger reads Adam's essay, Learning to Embrace Sexuality's Gray Areas.
It would be 88 days until I saw her again. Sitting quietly on my bed as I packed my last belongings into two suitcases, she began to cry. This was the beginning of the end, but all I knew was that I had a 6:10 a.m. flight, and it was already 1 a.m. We embraced once more, and then I watched as the fog engulfed her white sedan. 11 days later, I tried to rest on my bed in a humid college dorm room. There was just enough space for a metal-framed bunk and a handful of excitement and anxiety. I was wearing my first pair of boxer briefs when a new friend from downstairs came in and lay beside me. He was slender and pale, collarbones peeking from a blue t-shirt, his sun-bleached hair brushing my face as he stroked my chest. Slurring his words from an evening of drinking cheap vodka, he slid closer and whispered a mixture of Beyoncé lyrics and sexual suggestions into my ear. Then he rolled on top of me, pinning one of my arms against the cold wall and the other beneath his goosebumped forearm. He had the same name as me. And suddenly, Adam's lips were on my lips. And Adam's hands were on my waist. In a matter of minutes, an Adam from suburban Texas and an Adam from California had intertwined and merged into a composite Adam. For the next 77 days, I fought off accusations of ambivalent sexuality by clinging to a single framed picture of Bridget and me. I was afraid to admit that I had fallen from the grace of my long-distance, long-term girlfriend. I was afraid to admit that my chance encounter with Adam was anything more than a drunken happenstance, even if it was one I had wondered about for years. On the 88th day, I received an early morning text message. Bridget was at the airport in California, traveling to spend Thanksgiving week with me. Sweet relief. At last, I would have a breathing, tangible woman to support my frail defense. I was lugging my clean laundry from the basement in a torn blue hamper when she called. "I got dropped off at a gate," she said. "Now where do I go?"
"Go straight through the gates and turn right," I replied, coolly. Once outside, I approached her with exhilaration and a sense of reprieve and was greeted with a sudden burst of speed and a tear-laden sob. Catching her in my arms, we were at last reunited. Adam's lips on Bridget's lips. Our week together consisted of us lying on my futon, making love and visiting New York City. Yet there was also a lot of strained silence. She commented on my shoulder muscles and how the training for track must be going well. She stared at me for hours.
stroking my hair, acting as if she never wanted to leave my side. But she also maintained a distance, questioning our love, and saying she thought she was putting more into it than I was. This was the middle of the end, and it was 3 in the afternoon. By Friday morning, I still hadn't given her a tour of my school, and then it was time to see her off. I watched as she climbed into the white airport van and disappeared into the fog. I first thought of my encounter with Adam as a tragedy, an explosion in my otherwise picturesque life that sent pieces of me flying in different directions. I viewed our act of affection as an act of terror committed against my relationship with Bridget. But I had also convinced myself that what happened wasn't technically wrong. I had had sexual relations with a man when I was in a relationship with a woman. It wasn't honorable, but I also didn't see it as being a crime against the sanctity of my love for Bridget. I had broken my idea of a standard relationship, relished in Adam's ribs, nestled in Adam's ribs, but in the end, I chose to ignore my feelings as inconsequential. By the time I came home in May, the love Bridget and I shared had taken a turn for the worse. I pleaded for her forgiveness, to grant me another opportunity to show that I did care, that I did want a life with her in the future, and that 3,000 miles of distance was not too much to handle. I yearned to confess my actions, to tell her that I had been with a man but had thought of her the whole time, and that I missed her but had wanted to seem strong and able to adapt to change. We lay in her bed, crying, clutching at the disintegrating threads of past success. Time and distance had driven us apart, and I feared all was lost. Over the summer, as my pleas for Bridget's love kept falling on deaf ears, I changed my strategy. I wrote on a typewriter, winding and rewinding the ink ribbon until I had transcribed the messages we had written each other. I took pen to paper, refusing a text message for a handwritten letter. I sent her photos taken on a film camera and gave her antiques, like a small pewter spoon she had adored when we went shopping together in dusty downtown stores. If I could reverse the course of our love's demise, I could turn back the clock and recover our passion. Swimming upstream in the increasingly full and ever-changing river of contemporary dating, however, I had to accept the facts. Antiquity would not be the answer. Going back in time wouldn't work. The subculture trend of reviving decades-old cameras, typewriters, and clothing could not counteract the surging romantic tendency to opt for a text message, a mysterious video chat, or a posted photo for loving adoration. Even so, I struggled to yield to the increasingly impersonal state of love. How can an emotion that has dictated wars, driven men and women to commit disastrous acts, and fueled works of art for centuries be compressed to 140 characters or 22 megapixels or even a 5-inch screen? In the fall, I left that school for another. And it wasn't until the following spring that I shared the story of what had happened with someone else. On a rainy walk back to my dorm, I confessed to my track teammate that I had once been with a man, hinting at my sexual disposition. And, much to my delight, he was happy to hear it. By then, I had learned to accept my personal leanings and embrace my sexuality for what it taught me, not for what it took from me. I slowly began to reveal this to close friends, all of whom wore a look of surprise for a few moments before supplying words of encouragement and understanding. And it was at this point that I began to recognize that any future relationship, the next after my almost 4-year bond with Bridget, would be radically different. My ideas about love and sexuality had been black and white. There was no room in my mind for gray areas. You were either gay or straight. And I had never dreamed of falling in love with anyone but a woman. While I had wondered what it would be like to be with a man, I had ignored that curiosity, assuming I was heterosexual only. But once I was able to see desire as being on a spectrum, on a sliding scale balanced by opportunity and risk, I no longer felt so alone. I still hung on Bridget's every word until my love for her began to dry up in the late summer heat. After staying up all night talking to her on the phone one last time before I would return to school, I finally felt okay about both my sexual ambiguity and our failed relationship. The sun rose on a new day, and I feared no more. This was the end of the end, and it was 5 in the morning. For once, it wasn't foggy.
Nico Tortorella, reading Adam Lundquist's essay, Learning to Embrace Sexuality's Gray Areas. In a minute, we'll catch up with Adam and hear how Bridget reacted to his essay after it was published.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Adam says that this essay appearing in the New York Times was how he told his parents about his sexuality.
Prior to writing this essay, a couple of close friends knew, but outside of that, no one else knew that I had been with a man, that I was curious about my sexuality, or that I felt that I may be bisexual. And so this essay was an opportunity to finally open up to myself. And then when it was, you know, selected and then published, was an avenue for me to then share with my family in the most honest way I could.
When Adam did call to tell his parents that he was bisexual, they were fine with it. As for his ex-girlfriend Bridget, when Adam found out that his essay had been accepted by the New York Times, he knew he had to talk to her.
I had emailed her just before I called her, so I said, you have an email in your inbox with the essay attached. I don't want to preface it, I just want you to read it. She called me back a few minutes later and was not upset, I would say. She expressed to me that she was glad I was able to speak my truth. Overall, she was super gracious. The most, like, wonderful response I could have hoped for from someone that I hid something so large from.
Now, Adam says he's willing to admit something that he never knew how to say before.
I'm willing to say that, you know, I am bisexual. Like, I am ready to own that label, and I feel comfortable saying that. Once I had this initial experience with the other Adam, I began to realize that it was okay to not feel straight and to know that there's other possibilities, that it's not just you're either gay or you're straight, and there's so much in between.
Adam says that he initially wrote this essay just for himself, but when the piece came out in the New York Times, he got a flood of messages from people who said that he had put into words something they'd been feeling for a long time.
Life isn't so stringent, and your sexuality shouldn't feel like a coffin that you're either in or you're out. You know, there is so much gray space, and that it's okay to exist in that gray space.
Adam Lundquist. He's a PhD student at the University of Southern California studying neuroscience and Parkinson's disease. After the break, Daniel Jones on what he's reading from writers about sexuality early in their college experiences.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says that Adam's struggle with who he thought he was versus who he really is a good metaphor for what a lot of college students go through.
For me, it's an essay that represents the college experience in a lot of ways, where you come in with, you know, a sense of who you are based on who you've been and who people expect you to be. And then you're dumped into this, you know, melting pot of being challenged from different directions and hopefully discovering who you are, like who you really are through these experiences. And I think Adam charts that journey so well.
Thanks again to Nico Tortorella. Here's why he chose to read Adam's piece.
I just saw a lot of myself in it. I've been on this journey of sorts, understanding not only my own sexuality, but understanding how we got to this point in today's society of sexuality, and more importantly, love. Why do we love the people that we do? And when I hear and when I see another man writing about it, it just gives me hope.
Nico Tortorella. You can see him now in TV Land's Younger. He also hosts his own podcast, The Love Bomb, with Nico Tortorella. Coming up next week, Kira Sedgwick.
At 46, I had been burned to ash by divorce and had crawled back toward life, sometimes on hands and knees. The common wisdom is that people, in seeking love, risk losing themselves. But I did not fear this loss. And I thought that not choosing for myself might work better than choosing. I didn't wonder about what my perfect person would be like. I was way beyond that kind of amusement.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Additional sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. You can always get more Modern Love on Facebook. Join the community at facebook.com/modernlove. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.